I wanted to talk about some things, you know, as always, that have come up during the week that have impacted me. But I think I want to start here. I was adopted, and I don't know how many of you are adopted. It wasn't a big traumatic thing. I was adopted. My sister was adopted, and my parents, for whatever reason, couldn't have children. And from the very beginning, they always told me that I was adopted. I can't remember a time that I could actually think that I didn't know that I was adopted. So it was no big traumatic thing finding out later in life or anything. Later in life, my sister did decide to try to track down her birth parents, and she found them. It didn't go too well. I never had the desire. I think it's more of a female thing to want to do that than a male thing. I did put a waiver in my file at the adoption agency, so should my birth parents ever do the same thing, they could put us together, but after 20 years, no word, so I'm not holding my breath. And my adoptive parents were wonderful. They provided well. They were a little emotionally aloof. That was just their style. And sometimes I felt like a black sheep. You know, it's like an alien sometimes, because I had such a different take on life, it seemed. I was the artsy guy who always wanted to go out and be a musician, be this, and my dad was a steady guy who had the 40-year job at the gas company and all of that. But for the most part, I really didn't think a whole lot about it. Later in life, I started to realize that I had a sort of a different view on family and a different view on relatives and other people that I knew. And when I started to think about why it was that for me, you know, family wasn't the main connection point of my life, I guess is the best way to put it, I realized it's because I had no blood connection. The only blood relatives that I know are my two children, that are my children. We have a blended family, and so I've got two kids and then two kids together. Actually, I have three children total. And those are my only known blood relatives. Doesn't necessarily bother me. I think it bothers Marion more than it bothers me. She can't look up a family medical history, you know. And, you know, I see all those things on the website now, web about finding your genealogy and your family tree and all that sort of thing. And I realize, I don't know if I even have a bush. What's going on here? What you get in the papers is so minuscule. I mean, I've got a sheet that says, you know, my given name was John Joseph Avalos. I know that I was French, Italian, and Spanish, mostly Spanish, I suppose. I sometimes fantasize that maybe I'm part Murano, which is a Jewish Spaniard, you know, a Jew who was forced to become Catholic. And I think, hey, that's cool, because why do I have this affinity for Judaism? Maybe that's happening back there. I know that my grandfather was a concert pianist, so that's kind of cool, you know. But it's a weird sort of thing that for me, blood is not the most important thing. And I know people, like I talk to Scotty sometimes, he talks about this intense connection that his family has, you know, and the relatives are always getting together and doing this and doing that. And on one hand, sometimes I feel like I missed out. On the other hand, I think there are certain advantages as well, because for me, my family is who is ever choosing to be with me. Because as long as I can remember, that's what I had. I had parents who chose to be with me. They chose me. They went through the legal process and brought me home. It wasn't a happenstance. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't a surprise. It was a considered decision that they made. And maybe as a father in a blended family, that's an advantage too, because I make absolutely no distinction between the children of blood and the children of my family and connection. It just doesn't even occur to me that there would be a difference. But as I kind of go through life more and more, I realize that there is this sort of tick in my head, and it just is what it is. And as I look at what Jesus thought about family, it started to get interesting to me, and that's what I wanted to share with you this morning. Because Jesus actually says very little about family. Do you know that? You would think he'd be saying tons about family. Being that he's all about connection and unity and oneness, that family would be something that he would spend a lot of time on, but he doesn't. And the most fascinating thing is that when he does talk about family, it's in a way that you would never expect. It's almost disparaging. It's almost like he's putting it down or moving away. I mean, think about the first incident that we have in his life after the birth narratives is in Luke 2, when his family goes into Jerusalem for the festival, and he stays behind afterwards, and his parents get a whole day's journey out. It's 3 days before they can find him, and they're frantic, as any parent would be. And he calmly says, "Didn't you know I'm supposed to be about my father's business?" He's almost chiding his mother for the reaction that she has. You know, so there's always this sort of tension with Jesus and his family. And he never really comes down where you would expect. And I think there's a reason for that. And that's what I wanted to share with you this morning. Take a look, if you want to, at your bulletins at Matthew 12, 46, 50. And here's another one of these passages that just sort of bangs your head against a brick wall. While Jesus was still speaking to the crowds, behold, his mother and brothers were standing outside seeking to speak to him. And someone said to him, "Behold, your mother and brothers are standing outside seeking to speak to you." But Jesus answered the one who was telling him and said, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, "Behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my brother and sister and mother." Now, it's hard for us to understand, as modern Westerners, just how shocking that statement would have been to the hearers, whoever overheard Jesus. It wasn't just rude. It was beyond rude. It's hard for us to understand the intensity and what family meant to an ancient Middle Eastern culture that was a shame and honor society. And I don't know if you know what that means, a shame and honor society. But in a community-based culture, where the individual only existed to serve the community, not the other way around. You know, in our culture, the community, the state, exists to serve the individual. In this culture, community was everything. What the community thought about you, what the community thought about your family, determined whether you basically lived or died. Because if you were shamed, you were ostracized. If you were ostracized, if you were cut off from the life of the community, you literally could not survive. Especially in the nomadic days when they were still living in tents, survival meant connection with the group. If the individual was not connected to the family, there was no survival. To be put outside the city gates was a death sentence. We don't get that anymore, do we? For a family to be shamed and ostracized from the community meant that that family was cut off, meant that family could not survive. You know, we look at Arab cultures today and they just seem so incredibly brutal and uncivilized, and we don't understand that they are still a shame and honor society. These honor killings that you hear about, where even if a young daughter or sister is raped and then the brothers kill her to maintain honor to their family, it's because in that culture, to have a woman having any sort of relations outside of wedlock is a shame on the entire family, even though it may not be her fault. It's strange to our ears. It's barbaric to our ears. But to maintain honor in that society, and the only way to then return to honor is to kill the person who has brought shame to your family. It's hard for us to get that. You know, the blood feuds that were engendered in the ancient Middle East, if someone even inadvertently killed a member of your family, you were duty-bound, honor-bound to kill someone back in order to maintain your honor. In Japanese culture, it's becoming more westernized, but especially back even a few generations ago, saving face was everything to the Japanese because they're a community-based society. To lose your honor, one would rather commit harakiri than to go on in that state if honor couldn't be restored. And so all of these cultural precepts are there and present when Jesus says such a thing. The commandment of the Decalogue to honor father and mother was so strongly rooted in Hebrew culture that you would never, never shame your parents. You would never dishonor your parents. That's why the prodigal son is such a strong statement that we also don't understand. For the son to ask his father for his inheritance, now to take it away from the clan, from the family, was something that was punishable by death. And so for Jesus to say this is truly shocking, but he's doing it for a specific purpose. This notion of blood was so strong in the Hebrew mind. Jesus was trying to move beyond it. He was trying to move them beyond it. He was trying to expand the notion of family. And to the Hebrews, family was already expanded. Family to the Hebrews wasn't the mother and the father and 1.75 children or 2.5 or whatever it is now in the average that we think of in the nuclear family. It was the extended family. It extended to all of the brothers and sisters and cousins and uncles and aunts, even to the entire clan, tribe, and nation. But it was still based in blood. The Jews did not see someone outside their bloodline as being part of their family. And Jesus is trying to expand this notion, saying, we set these division points, we set these compartments at such artificial places in our minds and in our hearts. It's not just an accident of birth that you are connected to each other. It's a decision that you make. It's those who do the will of the Father, that is, to live as I live and love as I love, that are your true brothers and sisters, who are your family. And even those who don't are still, he's going to say later, are your true family. And we need to treat them as such. Look at this next passage in Luke 14, 26, 33. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Now, even allowing for the fact that hate there, sana in Aramaic, doesn't mean a malicious hate the way we think of it. It just simply means to prefer less. He who does not prefer less, all of these connections, all of these ties, all of these familiar things in his life, is not going to be worthy of me. What's he talking about there? It's just so counterintuitive. There is a mode of communicating in ancient Hebrew writing that deals with their mode of poetry. To us, poetry repeats certain sounds, right? The ending sounds, if they're repeated, we call that rhyme. If the beginning sounds are repeated, we call that alliteration. If the middle sounds are repeated in a word, we call it assonance. And those are the things that give us the sense of connection in our poetry, in Western poetry. To the Jews, they didn't repeat sounds. They repeated concepts. That's why when you read the especially the Old Testament, it sounds so repetitive. It seems redundant. You're hearing the same thing over and over again. That's Jewish poetry at work. They are reinforcing the concept by repeating it using different analogies, different words. If you read the rest of this passage, what you see is Jesus reinforcing the same concept over and over again with different images to try to get the point across. And it also defines what he's talking about in the first line, which is so difficult for us to understand. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And he who does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish it, all who observe it will begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Shame and honor again, right? The rest of your community think of you? Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So then, none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. What is Jesus trying to say? He's trying to say those things that we hold on to, those things that have become familiar in our lives, that have become the touchstones in our lives for no other reason than because they're familiar, because they're what we've always known, because they were what we were always taught. Those things are the things that limit us. Those that create the walls, the ceiling, and the floor of our own particular prison. The truth that Jesus has can release us, can take us to a place that we never even imagined existed, but only if we're willing to lay down the things that we hold on to so dearly. Even the blood ties that can be so strong to us. Lay them down, he's saying. If you can't, it's not that you're not worthy of me in a less than sort of situation. It's that you simply won't be able to follow where I'm going. You cannot go there. You are shelved off. There is a glass ceiling to how far you can follow into this place of complete newness. This place that it almost seems so alien to you right now, but which will expose a truth of a radical love that cuts through all of these things, even through the bloodlines. Matthew 15:21. Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And a Canaanite woman from that region came out and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and implored him, saying, "Send her away, because she keeps shouting at us." But he answered and said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." And in other words, he's telling her, "I came to deal with my own blood kind, my kin. Those Jews, those Israelites, you are not from our clan. I'm not here for you," he's saying. But she came and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, does that sound like a statement that would come out of our Lord? I mean, come on. Poor lady, she's coming to him for help, and he calls her a dog? Do you remember the passage in Matthew 7, part of the Sermon on the Mount? Another shameless plug there. The passage in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, don't cast your pearls before swine. Don't give what is holy to dogs. There is a precept there, and it sounds condescending. It sounds like we are putting the others in a lower place. But really, what the pearls meant, that was a euphemism in Hebraic thought. The pearls were wisdom. It was the wisdom from their teaching that you didn't give to people who were not yet ready for it, who couldn't understand it yet. Because to do so would be to just give them something as a swine couldn't, a pig couldn't discern between a kernel of corn and a pearl. You know, if he couldn't eat it, he would just trample it over. And so the analogy is there is you're giving something someone that they can't, something they can't digest, they can't use yet. We are supposed to meet people where they are, to see them enough, to know what it is that is relevant to them and useful to them. Give them what they need and not what we think they should have. And likewise, you don't give what is holy to a dog because they'll turn and tear you to pieces. In other words, don't have arguments with people that are only there to argue. If someone isn't really ready to learn, isn't really ready to have their heart changed, then what's the point? This illusion is coming back to that. He's telling her that what I have was for the people who were prepared, you know, by the promises of Abraham, by the boundaries of Torah, of the law, to receive what I have to give them. And you're not of that line. But she doesn't give up, does she? She said, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table." Wow. And then Jesus said to her, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed at once. Now, Jesus, of all people, is a pretty good judge of character. He shows that over and over again. He knows things about people before they even speak it. Did he know the kind of faith this woman had? I tend to think so. I think he was doing this for the benefit of his disciples. A Jewish man did not talk to a woman in the street in public at all, let alone someone who was not of his own clan or kin. This pagan woman, this Canaanite woman, for him to even be addressing her in the street was shocking. For their benefit, he goes through this kind of dance with her to show them the kind of faith that she has, to show them that she is mishpacha, their family, their extended family, that they don't need to set these artificial lines where they have set them, that she is one of them. And if that wasn't enough, then he does it again with a Roman centurion who comes to him in the same way. And he says, "No greater faith have I seen in all of Israel than this Roman, this hated oppressor, is showing you right now." And when he makes a point to walk through Samaria that most honorable Jews would not do, they would go 60 miles around, and he meets a woman at the well, and he addresses her, and he brings her into his fold. And again, his disciples are shocked. And when he's asked, "Who is my neighbor?" he spins a yarn about a Samaritan who is showing up the priests and the Levites of his own faith. What it means to be a neighbor, what it means to be connected to people. Jesus is going way beyond blood here. He's trying to teach a lesson and show everyone around him in the most shocking way available to him, that our family needs to expand. Our notion of family needs to expand. Now you might be asking, all right, so what? How does this help me in my everyday? And that's a good question. I'm always asking that. I never want to sit up here and just tell you stories about 2,000 years ago, no matter how interesting they may be, unless they connect in some way. And Jesus was absolutely practical. Everything he said to his disciples had a practical application. It could be used right that moment if you so chose. And there's no difference here. Because if we can't expand the notion of family in our own life, what that means to us, who we let in and who we shelve off, who we ostracize, who we are willing to connect with or not, then we're going to miss an essential truth. We all do the same thing, don't we? We divide things up in our lives. This is secular and this is sacred. This is where I go to worship and this is where I go to work. And gosh, I gotta fill up my tank enough in the time of worship so that I can just bridge and get through those secular dry waste times so that I can get back to the next time of worship again. We make these lines, these divisions. And the same thing with us and them, with prayer and worship. We make these bright lines between things that don't need to be connected as such. I just read an article by Peggy Noonan about the state of our country and how we're becoming two Americas, and it's tearing us apart at the seams. And she was lamenting the fact that we don't even see each other as having differences anymore. We see each other as good or evil based on the differences that we see in each other. The divide between Republicans and Democrats or liberals or whatever, these things are becoming so pronounced and so divisive and toxic that it's very difficult to even move forward as a country. We need to be careful as Christians, as followers of Jesus, as people of faith, that when we disagree with someone in the marketplace, which is not only our prerogative, it's also our right and our duty to do so, but that we don't at the same time see the other person as other. Most people want the same things. They want to be able to live their lives well and have their children be given a better life than the one that they have experienced. They have different ways of getting there. Is there a way for us to bridge those things together, to see family, to see mishkaha even between and among the people with whom we disagree? Boy, we better be able to. How do we call ourselves followers of Jesus if we can't do that? He said, yeah, it's easy to love the people who love you, who look like you and are tied by blood to you and agree with you. But how about those other guys? How are you going to feel about them? You know, this immigration controversy that is heating up is pitting us against these people who are of a different race or a different color, and we see them as illegal immigrants, and many of them are. But I'll tell you, from my time in Mexico for the last 25 years working in Tijuana and Central Baja, I have seen it from the other side too. And I'll tell you what, if my family was living in the conditions that they're living, I would be crossing any line that I could to get the food that they needed and to help my family to survive. Most of these people are doing more, no more or less than that. If they've broken the law, then they need to answer to the law. But we need to guard our hearts so that we don't see them as other. They are people trying to live their lives and provide for their families as we are. If they did it in a way that needs to be corrected, okay, let's correct that. But our hearts are delicate things. And if we give over to that loss of a connection, a human connection with people, we have lost a part of ourselves. We have lost the way that Jesus is trying to show us to move through right now. He's trying to open us up. He's trying to unify us. He's trying to help us to see everyone as ourselves. We just started this recovery line last week, and we've already gotten 3 calls. It may not sound like a lot, but it was interesting. And I got to take each one of them. It's a strange thing to start a program that you kind of have, you know, sort of abstractly in your head, oh, this is a good thing to do. And then you get a live, breathing person on the other line whose life is in complete turmoil, and they're breaking down and crying on the phone, and you hear that desperation in their voice. It's like, oh my gosh, was I ready for this? You know, what did I do? And you just talk to them. They're a person. You know, I had this young 29-year-old woman call yesterday, and she's an alcoholic, and she can't stop drinking no matter what she's tried. And you know, she's driven her car into the side of her neighbor's house or something, and her parents finally had enough is enough. You've got to get some help. And I'm talking to her. I said, have you ever been in recovery? Well, yeah, I went to a few meetings. Do you have a sponsor? Well, I used to. I said, well, why don't you have one now? I don't know. And I had to tell her, it is the community of recovery that creates lasting sobriety. It's the connection that you have, so that when you hit a weak moment and you know you can call your sponsor, you know you can go to a meeting, you know you can call a friend. Without that, what have you got? See, we in our individualized society now, we think that we can be alone and do things on our own and accomplish things, but that's not the way we were created. We are created to be in community. We are created to have sponsors to call. We are created to have meetings to go to. Whatever those look like in our lives, without them, we can't survive. Without them, we can't move through the stages of recovery and transformation that Jesus is trying to get us to go through. She needed community. She gave up on the community, and she found herself in a predictable and familiar place. Seems like she wants to change. Hopefully, she will, by building the community, by not drawing these bright lines, you know, between people and things, so that everything stays in its compartment and is no longer unified. Had a 60-year-old man call me. His wife is now addicted to prescription drugs because of a chronic illness and chronic pain. And the desperation in his voice, I just wanted to grab through the line and somehow hold him. But I asked him, you know, do you have any experience with alcoholism or drug addiction in your life? And he said, no. Have you been to an Al-Anon meeting? He said, I went once, but then my wife was better for 2 weeks and I thought everything was going to be fine, and so I stopped going. I said, do you realize how everything you're saying is absolute classic alcoholic addictive behavior? If you can connect in Al-Anon, if you can reconnect in community, you're going to hear these stories and it's going to strengthen you. It's going to get to a place where you can't control her behavior, but you can certainly start to live your life again. Community. It's about community and connection. I had someone come up to me at the Hodan and say, you know, I keep trying to change patterns and habits in my life, but they keep coming back. How do you do it? How do you get to the place where these things really start to change? And I told him, you know, the only thing that I can tell you is you keep showing up. You just keep showing up. When everything in your head is telling you to isolate or telling you to do this or that or the other familiar destructive thing in your life, you show up to community. You show up to another person. You immerse yourself in the moment. And if you have to remind yourself to do that every 5 minutes, when you realize you're back in your head spinning with all those toxic thoughts, you stop, you break the connection, and you move back out and look into the eyes of the person you're with. Have a real conversation. Care about what they're saying. You have no idea what it will do to you just to move out of your head and into someone else's space just for a moment to get a vacation from your thoughts. But beyond that, the building of that pattern in your life will take you to a place that Jesus calls kingdom, that the Jews called mishpacha, family, connection, support. Immersion in community is everything that Jesus was trying to teach us. Expanding our notion of community is the prerequisite for us being able to do that. Whether we're at work or whether we're at church or where we may be at home, but to no longer see places of this or that, but to see everything as continual prayer, to see everything as continual community, to see everything as one moment that just morphs and changes, but the moment stays and remains, the only moment that exists, this one right here, right now. That's where Jesus was trying to bring us. I ran across a story that I want to read you in closing here. And I don't know if any of you have ever had an experience with an adult Down syndrome. A Down syndrome adult, I guess. I remember the first time that I did, I was on tour with a musical group, and we were in Pennsylvania, and we played at a home for disabled children. And some of these children were now 30 years old. And I remember the look on some of the female cast members' face when a 30-year-old, 6-foot man comes barreling across the yard and envelops her in a bear hug. And she is just freaking out. But it was like a 7-year-old doing it, you know, because that's where they were. They were the sweetest, most, just becoming people. Amazing. This story is that kind. It's called God Under My Bed. And the writer writes, "My brother Kevin thinks God lives under his bed. At least that's what I heard him say one night. He was praying out loud in his dark bedroom, and I stopped outside his closed door to listen. 'Are you there, God?' he said. 'Where are you?' 'Oh, I see, under the bed.' I giggled softly and tiptoed off to my own room. Kevin's unique perspectives are often a source of amusement, but that night something else lingered long after the humor. I realized for the first time the very different world Kevin lives in. He was born 30 years ago, mentally disabled as a result of difficulties during labor. Apart from his size, he's 6'2", there are very few ways in which he is an adult. He reasons and communicates with the capabilities of a 7-year-old, and he always will. He will probably always believe that God lives under his bed and that airplanes stay up in the sky because angels carry them. I remember wondering if Kevin realizes he is different, if he is ever dissatisfied with his monotonous life. Up before dawn each day, off to work at a workshop for the disabled, home to walk our Cocker Spaniel, returning to eat his favorite macaroni and cheese for dinner, and later to bed. The only variation in the entire scheme are laundry days, when he hovers excitedly over the washing machine like a mother with her newborn child. He does not seem dissatisfied. He lopes out to the bus every morning at 7:05, eager for a day of simple work. He wrings his hands excitedly while the water boils on the stove before dinner, and he stays up late twice a week to gather our dirty laundry for his next day laundry chores. And Saturdays. Oh, the bliss of Saturdays. That's the day my dad takes Kevin to the airport to have a soft drink, watch the planes land, and speculate loudly on the destination of each passenger inside. 'That one's going to Chicago,' Kevin shouts as he claps his hands. His anticipation is so great he can hardly sleep on Friday nights. I don't think Kevin knows anything exists outside his world of daily rituals and weekend field trips. He doesn't know what it means to be discontent. His life is simple. He will never know the entanglements of wealth or power, and he does not care what brand of clothing he wears or what kind of food he eats. He recognizes no differences in people, treating each person as an equal and a friend. His needs have always been met, and he never worries that one day they may not be. His hands are diligent. Kevin is never so happy as when he is working. When he unloads the dishwasher or vacuums the carpet, his heart is completely in it. He does not shrink from a job when it is begun, and he does not leave a job until it is finished. But when his tasks are done, Kevin knows how to relax. He is not obsessed with his work, nor the work of others. His heart is pure. He still believes everyone tells the truth, that promises must be kept, and when you are wrong, you apologize instead of argue. Free from pride and unconcerned with appearances, Kevin is not afraid to cry when he is hurt, angry, or sorry. He is always transparent, always sincere. And he trusts God. Not confined by intellectual reasoning, when he comes to Christ, he comes as a child. Kevin seems to know God, to really be friends with him in a way that is difficult for an educated person to grasp. God seems like his closest companion. In my moments of doubt and frustrations with my God, I envy the security Kevin has in his simple faith. It is then that I am most willing to admit that he has some divine knowledge that rises above my mortal questions. It is then that I realize that perhaps he is not the one with the handicap. I am. My obligations, my fear, my pride, my circumstances, they all become disabilities when I do not submit them to Christ. Who knows if Kevin comprehends things I can never learn? After all, he has spent his whole life in that kind of innocence, praying after dark and soaking up the goodness and love of the Lord. And one day, when the mysteries of heaven are opened and we are all amazed at how close God really is to our hearts, I'll realize that God heard the simple prayers of a boy who believed that God lived under his bed. But Kevin won't be surprised at all. I remember the first time that I realized I could love a Downs child. We had Brennan late in life. He was a surprise. Good surprise. But since Marion was already in her 40s, we were advised to have an abortion or at least have an amniocentesis because he might be spina bifida, he could be Downs. And of course, we didn't believe in that. But I was also just kind of struck to my core. If my son, if my daughter were Down syndrome, could I handle that for the rest of my life? To raise them and to be with them for the rest of my life or the rest of theirs as if they were still 5 or 7 years old? And I was sitting in a parking lot during the pregnancy, just leaving someplace. And before I left, a girl rode up on a bicycle wearing a Burger King uniform, going to work at the Burger King right there in front of me. And I realized that she was Down syndrome. And she had a bag with her, and she had, it looked like a lunch, and she was going to work. And all of a sudden, I don't know, for whatever reason, my heart just went out to her. And I just realized, if this was my daughter, if I packed her lunch and sent her off on her bicycle to work and welcomed her home at night, I could do that. I could do that. You know, I could go beyond my notions of what a perfect child would be, could be, should be, and I could love whatever came. And we didn't have that amnio. We didn't even go there. We just accepted whatever happened. And of course, he was perfect, but if he hadn't been, I could have done it. And this is all Jesus is asking of us. To move beyond the preconceptions, to move beyond the limitations that we set for ourselves. To go beyond blood and the things that are familiar. To find this truth that will truly free us into something we haven't even imagined. That's where he's trying to take us. That's where we can go in him. Let's pray. Father, even as I hear myself saying these words, it just seems incredible to me that you love us the way that you do. That there is this abandon in you. There is this allness in you that even now I can't really fully comprehend. But I believe that it's true, and I'm going to live my life as best I can. And I pray that we would all just do the best that we can. To continue to lay down the things that hold us back. To move towards you with abandon, with increasing momentum and speed, as we start to sense who it is that we're pursuing. That there's no downside. That there is no bad news. Only good news in you. Help us to quicken our pulse, Lord. To stoke our thirst for you. And to see everyone alongside us as partners. In this whole life, this connected life that we live. Thank you, Lord, for everything that you've given us and for the ability to be able to do what you've asked us to do, which is simply to be one with you. We love you, Lord. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.